Welcome to Dr. Fred Bell's Health Science and Evening Energy Show, pre-recorded, as usual, for Saturday night, March 7th. We're going to do a San Diego Expo tonight and maybe a little bit of UFO panel or another old radio show. Who knows? It's always fun to do this stuff.
He's going around. He's spreading energy. So
there we go. Here's Dr. Bell.
People that are infected in different colors, and he'll start attracting people that are generating or effervescing in that color. And so your whole life starts to change when you get into this technology. As your aura field changes, and you'll find yourself, some of your friends you thought are
the amethyst receptor,
people you never thought you'd ever meet are right in your face, and your whole life starts to change. So it's a whole process of not only physical, but it's a spiritual, environmental process too. Yeah. She's asking if the stone changes periodically. It takes 90 days to reproduce the red blood cell and 7 years to change the whole body. So somewhere in that period, you will probably change receptors. You'll know. You will absolutely know when it's time. It won't work anymore like it did. And you take it off, and you may feel like you're floundering again. So we have one that's called a silver receptor. This is a zinc and cadmium one. They also pull radiation off your body. Cadmium is very good for doing that. Radiation is very prevalent on this planet. If you were to take a pregnant woman who was eating dairy products, and she was in her ninth month of pregnancy, and her breast milk was there, and she was eating all the dairy products, like most women do, and men, I know some don't, but if she were to cross the state line, she could be arrested by the FDA for transporting a radioactive substance, her breast milk, across the state line. About every woman on this planet right now has radioactive breast milk, strontium-90 if you measure it. So it's necessary to pull radiation off the body. But at the same time, when you wear the receptor, you're able to process radiation because it has an enhancement effect. And when you use our vitamins that we have to go with it, with the ginseng and the gotapoa and the flotaya in it, it also keeps the electrolytes higher in the brain. I don't have time to explain now, but what happens is if you amplify your aura field, and you can amplify your aura field by using what's called a systems technology. And when this happens is it takes less electricity in the brain to send these pulses through the central nervous system. It means like you change your wiring from lead to copper to eventually platinum. And when you make this change, 10 volts of electricity would produce an effect. When you make the change, 1/10 of 1 volt would produce a higher electrical effect. So when you start pushing your aura field further and further out, the aura field then repels radiation. Because what radiation actually ends up doing, where it's harmful to the human body, is when radiation is absorbed by the body, it converts itself into electromagnetic energy, which then causes what are called free radicals, free electrons to be formed, and they go out and start causing pollution in the body. That's what radiation does. But if your body is high electronically, it cannot be affected electromagnetically by a step-down version of radiation when you're exposed to it. I was exposed to huge amounts of nuclear radiation when I was a kid. Now, the reason we call it the nuclear receptor is because it's working on the nuclear forces within the DNA. Okay? What? Yeah. Yeah, you've been wearing it for quite a while now, haven't you? And like I say, when we finish here, you can check some of this out. I don't have a booth here this year, but because I don't have the time, I've got to leave. But we'll have a little activity back here at the end of the seminar if you want to check some of this out. But one of the things I want to bring out real quick while I'm at it is the tremendous effect of wearing a pyramid. 1975. I wore one every day for 8 years without ever taking it off, even in public. And this is what happens. When you breathe air in, It comes down into the lungs, and the air is full of chemicals. There's about 500 different chemicals in the air. And then what happens is, the air goes into the lungs, and goes through the lungs, into the blood veins, and goes up to the head. Well, the size of the blood veins from the lungs to the head are very large, huge, very large arteries. As soon as the blood arrives at the cerebellum, which is the base of the brain, the cerebellum reduces the arterial size to a millionth of an inch. So what happens is, if you've got this huge pipe going in, and then a billion little teeny-weeny ones, and there's a bunch of dirt and this water in this pipe, it's going to clog up the little pipes, isn't it? Because then it's not going to fit. So what happens is the cerebellum acts like a strainer. And so pretty soon, it fills up. And the cerebellum is responsible for your balance. Remember how when you were kids, we'd do one foot, we'd go skipping forward, and we'd skip back, we'd reach down, touch the ground, and then all of a sudden people couldn't do that anymore, and you got older? It's because the balance center is full of pollution. And this gradually spreads to the midbrain, which hits endocrine function. Endocrine function, when that gets struck with this pollution, this blocking of the arteries, you start getting where you become allergic to things, you get what you never were before. You have all kinds of chemical reactions going on in your body that are very strange, that are not seemingly curable, until finally get up to the pineal gland, the pituitary, which causes senility, and you completely lose it altogether. So when you put the pyramid on, what happens is it breaks all that stuff loose and it comes back into your bloodstream and it comes down to your liver. When it gets down to your liver, if you're really toxic, you can't handle that much detoxification, so you get a splitting headache. So you have to take the pyramid off, drink a lot of water with it, and take vitamin C and then work through that, so then put the pyramid back on when the headache goes away. And eventually, you won't have a headache anymore, and your mind will be a lot clearer. No, you don't have to wear it all the time, but I'd wear it. Yeah. But I don't wear it that much in public anymore. I had a lot of good experiences with it, though. So. Oh, they were very positive. This is a nuclear disc you carry around in your pocket, because the pyramid energy is kind of hard if you want to carry the big pyramid around. Like you go in a restaurant and you know what's in the food, the pH factor might be shot, so you put the pyramid over the food. This is something you can put the plate over, you know, underneath the plate. It works a lot better. There's a million different applications for pyramids in the home. This is another item that's very important, and we make different sizes of them. Sleep in. One of the biggest areas that ELF affects is sleep and regular radiation, especially microwave. You ever go to sleep at night, just as you doze off, you jump like that? That's because your etheric body is normally locked into your physical body pretty tightly because of what's called spinal compression. I'm sure you've heard that some of the astronauts get an inch taller when they're in space. And they start having spiritual experiences. Well, that's because the etheric body decompresses. And they're not around terrestrial radiation. So when you lay down at night and go to sleep, your aura field comes out 2 inches at first. Only 2 inches. You can see it with certain kinds of dye photography now. During this time, your body is charging up on the anima mundi of the earth, which I was telling you is 1/2 degree off. Actually, it's 1 degree off this year. So it's 1 degree off. So your body, if it's new age type, it'll align automatically, make that compensation. If it's not, you'll start to degenerate quicker. So what happens is an electrical field comes along and strikes your body. Well, your body is open, vulnerable to electricity, to radiation. It's more direct. It doesn't have all the shielding now. So what happens is this field has to compress itself back inside your body. So you get that. It feels like you're falling, but really you're not. You're shrinking is what it is. But because, you know, it's like when this happens, you get this reaction. You know what I mean? It's like something pushes and forces your emotional body out a little bit. So when you sleep inside of a pyramid, that doesn't happen. It stops all that radiation. really interesting. We discovered that back years ago when they were trying to X-ray the Great Pyramid for hidden chambers, and they found that X-rays wouldn't penetrate.
Does it matter what material the pyramid's made out of?
Yeah, it really matters. Never make a pyramid out of plastic or aluminum, because it produces a positive ion effect. Makes you very sick. We use all natural metals and enamels on ours. We used to plate them, but the EPA came along and made plating so strict that it would cost these guys $500,000 to plate something that big. So we don't. We still put a gold capstone on it, which is 24 karat gold, to keep so you don't have to align it to the north. Any pyramid that has gold on it doesn't have to be aligned to the north, because the gold molecule is pyramid shaped. Then once you are sleeping in the pyramid, it's much easier to get to the next stage, which is 13 feet or more out. 13 feet or more out is REM sleep, and that's where you do all your astral communication, whether it's beings that are disincarnated, teachers, extraterrestrials, whatever it is you do in your dream that's necessary to keep you sanity, it begins to happen. And of course, if you're constantly jumping all night, you'll go insane. It's interesting to note that serial killers, by the way, do not reach REM sleep. Now, radionics was discovered years ago by the government. It was documented. It was patented under the Hieronymus effect when they took pictures of in Cumberland Valley of insect-blighted crops, took the pictures, put them in a black box with insecticides and killed all the bugs that were in the crops miles away, using the farmers who owned the land. That was one of the necessary ingredients. From that science, we developed a positive side to it. This device right here is called a star orb. It's about this big, has a wire on it, like you see there. What we do with that device there, if you take that wire and we run it, we hang this thing somewhere in our house, and you go right to that plug where that ELF is. We run that wire right to the ELF. Then what we do, I'll draw this up so you can see how it goes. This is probably one of the most needed systems and very least expensive things we make. It really helps everybody. So you got this thing hanging in your house. It goes down to the plug. You don't put it in the vertical side, the electrocute. Can you put it in the plug right there? Okay. Then you take another wire and you go outside and you stick it in the ground. So you got this thing hooked to here. What it does, it takes the ELF, reverses its energy, and puts it right back in the ground again where it came from, and therefore it gets rid of all the ELF effects in your house. And you'll need one of these for each circuit in your house. For example, if you've got a couple of... I usually put them in the room that I'm in instead of all over the house. If you go into a room and you have lights up there and you got plugs along here, you'll find that some of the plugs and some of the lights will go off together when you pull the circuit breaker. That's one circuit where you want to get rid of the ELF. So you need to isolate all the circuits and put one of these on each one of your circuits. But so it doesn't get too expensive if you've got 50 circuits in your house, just find one room and find the circuit for that particular room. Okay? Well, the light bulbs don't have anything to do with ELF. The light bulbs put out a spurious radiation that generates their photons. They're out of phase with the normal. The best lights are grow lights or laser lights. Lasers don't illuminate rooms. We use them in the crystals. So you're better off getting grow lights, which are a non-toxic light. There's several different ones that are on the market now. This is a larger version of what we just showed you, and you can do many circuits with one of these. You can do the whole house with one of these if you want. It's called a Devastar. We've used them in high-rise buildings, large, places where they have big auditoriums and stuff. They want these things. This is a solar orb, and what it does is it goes over where you work. It's like if you're working in an office or something. What we usually do is put a piece of emerald up in that top chamber, because emerald is green and stimulates the intellect, and it produces a form of radiation that's positive that causes your mind to work a lot better. This is a version of it where we use a 50,000 volt power supply that generates a wind, an ion wind, And we use it as it's called the ion shower, and it cleans your aura field. And what happens is, like if you're being creative, when you first get up in the morning and you go outside, and when you get outside, you find that, you breathe a little automobile exhaust. Then you come back in 20 minutes later, like you went to the store, and you sat down, you're not creative anymore. It's all gone until the next day, until you sleep again. This reverses that because you've got carbon monoxide poisoning in the last 24 hours. These are the irradiator systems that the Andromedans are currently working through. They were brought here by the Pleiadians in the late 70s. And these grid systems are used 1, 4, or 7. They'll produce effects. They're about 6 to 7 feet tall. And they'll produce effects on the body that give you interdimensional experiences, physical levitation. TM of America has trained people to physically levitate them because they have an anti-gravity scalar wave field on them. And you can learn more about them in our tape series. These are crystals. We use master crystals in all of our systems that we bring from Arkansas and South America. This is a device that is used. Sumyasi brought this in 1981 from the Pleiades. And this is a device that reverses the effect of the full moon and the new moon. So that when you use this device in your home, your surface tension of your body doesn't change during a full moon, making you irritable, angry, and it makes you that effect negligible to your body. It's a beautiful device. This is some of the crystals that we use in our systems. We also have another form, some other light generators that we use. Sometimes I do seminars where we teach people how to program crystals and maybe teach people how to become contactees. We get them into the networks because now they've gone beyond the receptor and they're using them, but they're into something beyond that. So we start integrating the pyramid systems, the lasers, and a thing called the Firestar Orb. And people begin to have experiences. At this point, we start to add in the music also. And you can start to see in this light in here, but this is a huge, I'll show you a picture of it, this big fire star and this person standing over there. Now the Pleiadian music came about when Sumyasi began to teach us about how music, or how negative sounds destroy cells, and you get sound pollution. If you're used to hearing sirens and crowd noise and freeway traffic noise all the time, it deadens your cells. It's a dead energy. It's a negative effect to the chakra system. Eventually, it spreads through your body. So she said that. She brought a Pleiadian ship to Switzerland. We used 16 different tape recorders to record it from different angles. And out of that, we extracted a timber that was very necessary for the body to reverse the pollution effects. And what timber is if you were to play a piano in a middle C, you get one sound. If you were to play a violin in the middle C, same note, same octave range, different sound. The difference between the piano sound and the violin sound is called timbre. Certain timbres release negative energies from the cell, sound pollution, or they cause an enlightening process to the human system overall. These instruments were developed on the Pleiades and brought here. One of them is called the sitar. Sitar was brought here thousands of years ago by the Rishis, which are the messengers from the Pleiades to the Brahmins. And when a sitar is played by the right person, it's called a raga. And when you hear a raga, it brings your energy up and raises your consciousness. I remember back in the 60s, everybody was taking acid and they somehow or other strangely gravitated to the sitar to release this frustration. You didn't hear him play a tuba or a trombone, for example, taking an acid trip. They took listen to the sitar. Well, the times are now, the sitar is a limited instrument. So they gave us these sound characteristics, and with our computer synthesizers that we have now, we're able to produce harmonics and timbres that far exceed the sitar. So we started producing music. This is why that one gentleman said he'd heard me with Stephen Halpern, because Stephen and I did an album together. One of the first albums that I did was called The Fellowship. It's a 90-minute trip to the Pleiades with a Pleiadian ship, a real one, recorded all the way through subtly. Sometimes it's pretty loud, and synthesizers wrapped around it, so it makes it into a music score. The second one album that we did a different thing. We used dolphins and whale sounds, and we made a song that was under the water, and we call it Atlantis Rising, which creates another effect on the body. So when you listen to these different music tapes over a period of time, your whole consciousness will change. And they're really interesting. Some of the listeners, too, are really interesting. I found that a lot of musical people, like John Anderson from Yes and the people from the U2 band, use a lot of my music to listen to while they write their own music. So it was really interesting how I became a musician in the celebrity and the music world by never having to play to anybody, you know?
Like my son and his friends all listen to U2. Their music, has it changed to a better frequency?
Well, the Shake, Rattle, and Hum album was produced in one of my systems, if you listen to that.
So they aren't a totally negative influence.
Oh, no, they're not negative at all. In fact, they're a drug-free, alcohol-free band. They've been through. I toured 15 years with the Moody Blues. They went from lots of drugs to nothing. We put them on the vitamins. Their music got better. It was interesting. This is one of the systems that was set up in Hawaii. And this guy here... his name was Ron Spencer. Now he calls himself Maitreya, but he had a son. This little picture up there was born in one of these big systems. I had three kids with home births in pyramids, and we had on the last child we had no labor pains because we were able to get rid of labor pains. That's another phenomenon because the body is subjected, the reproduction system is subjected to some old thought forms, metaphors of this earth, that birth is pain, and it's not, it's ecstasy. So using the pyramids, we were able to subconsciously get rid of that programming in the female's mind. I had two children with one wife in that pyramid. The first one, she had about 45 minutes of contractions and somewhat the pain. But then when she had the second child, she had one contraction, and I caught the baby as it came out. She says, her water broke. It was in the evening, and we were going to call a midwife. We better call a midwife, right? She's not in no pain, like you're supposed to have pain, no pain. And the water broke, so I immediately called the midwife. But I had training on how to deliver a child. And just as the midwife walks in, she laid on the bed. Just laid down the bed, and I'm standing, out comes the baby. She says, oh, I think I had a contraction there, and the baby came out. And then we cut the cord, let her lay there for about an hour and a half. She got up and walked around. I mean, this is amazing. I mean, it works. And I've had other women have similar
experience.
In the pyramid, sleeping in it all the time, having the child in it. We have a nutritional system that's aligned to this energy. We use all natural ingredients, and if you look at my vitamin label, you'll see 230 ingredients on it, okay? You'll see herbs you've never even heard of before. We use three mushrooms in there to work through the triple meridian. But I don't even have time to get into that. We use B15, which is illegal because it's a nitrilocyte. B12 through B17, half of them are illegal. We use them all. Why? Because they make your body immune to cancer. You can't be subjected to carcinogenic vibrations or the AIDS vibration. It won't work in this. So we change your whole system around. Like I said, this is just an overview, and you need to get our tape series and learn about this stuff. To make a long story short, this is in 1981. When this system was put up in Hawaii, it was 4 days later, it was on Inner Island TV, and on the fifth day, the Dalai Lama walked in physically, took Ron to Tibet. He's been there off and on ever since. Now the systems are in all... Now in Kathmandu, they're building all the different systems up. And then they're building me a temple over there to go work in as a laboratory. I think they're trying to get me to come to Tibet. We have another type of device that breaks down Maya, the illusion. Okay? We're programmed by the scam lines on TV. We're programmed by the color of a candy wrapper. We're programmed so many ways by a dark, sinister force that works through the establishment. So we developed a device breaks that programming down. And if you're one of those that's programmed, you probably think you see a white triangle sitting there in the middle of that picture, which doesn't exist. And if you look at it and concentrate on it and relax looking at it, that white triangle goes away and you see three little small black triangles and three Pac-Men. That's the way it should be. You can't get caught up in illusion. Everybody noticing? Can you get rid of that triangle if you work on it? It's interesting, isn't it? Now, this is where we live, up in Laguna Beach, north of here, and we have a couple seminars there every year. And people come there and have an experience in these seminars. And a lot of, this is how people get into systems technology. That device up on the top, you see, is a champagne reflector, this thing way up there. And it breaks down all energies around it right into the fourth dimension. Now what I want to do before I go any further with these slides is I want to turn the lights off. Hey Rudy, can you turn the lights completely off for a minute now? Let's do this for a minute, then you guys can have... We're going over a little bit, but we started late, so what... Okay, so this is what it looks like in the daytime. Now at night, we start cranking up the lasers, and we're on top of a mountain on a volcano. We've had... Sai Baba has physically been in this house. We've had a lot of masters in there. We've had ETs in there. Andromedans are working this vortex. This vortex goes to Sedona. It goes to a lot of different places. It goes all over the world. We've got artifacts from different vortexes from all over the world in this system doing what they do. So we use about 5 different colors of lasers. And a laser amplifies the energy off the astral plane because the beam that comes out of a laser is pure photons, and photons are astral particles, they're not physical. Now here's that champagne reflector when it starts energizing and moving up in the frequencies. You can see that glow at the crystal in the top of it. And that, the reason that crystal is there is it captures the laser light so that it can't escape the boundary layers of those grids that it's sitting in. Then what happens is, in the room, as it cranks up more, anytime you live inside of a house, your body gives off amino acids. These amino acids over a period of years are stored in the wall. And if you sanctify the area, the amino acids are emitted from the wall and can be gathered up by astral beings. And this process is called ectoplasm. And so what happens is that big white thing that you see in the center there is an ectoplasm spill. It's coming off of that central machine that we're just talking about. And you see now the whole room starts getting etheric at this point. And this photographer that was taking these pictures from Germany, he specializes in etheric photography. So here now you see an angel that's manifested up in that reflector. To the left in the top, you see the wings spread. Remember I was telling you that Pleiadians teach us a lot about nature spirits. Well, that's one materializing right before your eyes in the slide. And this happens a lot. Different types come. People see them whenever they're in there. And that right there, see that, the wings? And the reason you're able to see it is because the angel's clothing itself in the ectoplasm in the room. The grid systems that you see are Pleiadian. They're focusing the energy. And, of course, there's music going on and lasers and stuff. There's sound vibration is set there, too. But it's only a slideshow, so we don't have any music. In the next slide, when he got that, he immediately... That angel wouldn't stay there long, so as it flew out, this next slide, it started to dissolve because it was outside the confines of that grid. So you can see here, it's coming out now. It's dissipating there. So that gives you an idea of just a tiny bit of some of the fun that you can have in these systems. At the same time, you're changing your entire environment, your entire life. And really, you can put the light back on now. Not too bright. Just crank it up a little bit. That's even more etheric. Sorry. This is a Firestar orb. This is one that is used separate from those systems. And what this is a channeling device. It's also used by contactees. How many of you remember Eric von Däniken when he wrote all those books? He gives seminars over in Europe, in Spain, in Mallorca, and different islands using one of these as a channeling device. They're quite effective. Okay, that's pretty much it for the slides for this part. turn the lights back up further now. I don't know how long we can have this room for, a few more minutes, probably not long. Any questions or anything? Yeah, that's in my tape series. Yeah, it's all in there, sure. A lot of information on that. Any other questions? They're back here at the table. I have two people back here, Lucille and Rudy. They'll test you if you want to find out which one you need before we leave here. I think some of the people have left. This kind of went over.
What's your art content?
Well, you just do what you're supposed to do.
All of these things are necessary.
Well, not really. I mean, it depends on what, if you fall into this. People fall into it, and then what happens is some people have entirely different experiences than others from these different grid systems once they're in that far. So what we do is we take people that are having similar experiences all over the world and we network them together. And then they can share and they can say, well, I added this and I made this change and this happened. And we've got a network of, I don't know, 20,000 people now using them. Maybe more. I lost track of them. I remember we had several thousand in Germany alone. We're way into Russia. I was given an award by the Russian government for this work. You know, they see it before our government does. So you can never tell. Okay, well, that's about the end of it then. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, that ended that part, little deal. So we'll have a little fun here now. We'll stop this puppy, and we'll go ahead and toss you in a what I call a bonus, you know. Or maybe we won't because the thing has to rewind a little bit. But let's see. Timing-wise, we're in good shape here. Yeah. So we're going to run a Dr. Fred Bell Health Science and Energy show from 1984, 11th, the 13th day of November 1984. I hope you enjoyed that little lecture. That was down in San Diego. That's the first time I think I ever met Carradine, David Carradine. He was there at that show. And, of course, he was at our show recently. Steve Barish flew out here on February 14th, and Dave Carradine was there with his Cosmic Rescue Team band and had a lot of fun. And his Kung Fu master was there. I didn't really talk to him. I talked to Dave for a while, but I did see his Kung Fu master there. He looked like a pretty cool guy, his teacher. And so we have a lot of fun over here at BBS Radio. We're growing. I know I have a huge Ustream. You guys get over on Ustream, you can actually, we're doing television simulcast too, so that works out pretty good. We seem to have a lot of fun with that. And in about a minute here, we'll start you off on another radio show from, we call Blast from the Past. You can't beat these Blast from the Past shows because they are just that. And it's fun because I'm writing this new book now, Inside Track, which we've been reading on Friday night, different sections of it. And some of this stuff was prophesized that came true since then. So here we go. Hang on.
We're going to talk more about those things that go bump in the lungs.
Things that go bump in the lungs?
Yeah, it's called particulate.
Particulate matter.
Yeah, bad matter. So we're going to continue on today with that.
Well, let me ask you something. Obviously, it must have rained last night in Laguna Beach where you are.
Yeah, it did.
What do you think the acid content of that rain was?
Last night, very low because, number one, I have a couple of white cars down here. They didn't have big brown and telltale spots on them. It was pretty low because also this storm that came up from the Hawaiian Islands out in the ocean area, out in the Pacific. And storms like this coming in are fast and strong, and they'll break things up. I mean, they'll break all this kind of pollution up. But as the weather department on television last night pointed out, this was the first storm like this we've had of this nature since last December. So I wouldn't count on this kind of relying on these storms to keep our air clean.
Now, see, that's something I don't understand about acid rain. You know, the wind flow tends to be from the Pacific on into California and then across the nation. And yet most of the complexes that generate the acid rain are further, I guess it would be further east than California.
Right. The number one primary cause of acid rain is coal, burning coal fuels and slower burning fossil fuels. For example, the kind of pollution that's put out in smelteries, like you have Bethlehem Steel, Kaiser Steel, all those steel mills all up down the east coast, especially up around Pittsburgh and that area. And so that's where the stuff comes from. But as I'll talk about particulate size today, what happens is the acid particles go up into the troposphere, which is high above the Earth, and then they're carried all the way around the Earth. So the danger and the concern with acid rain is that there's a band of these particles that are forming up high, you know, like 40, 50, 60,000 feet and constantly moving. Then what happens is when these inversions, you know, occur, these temperature inversions, which we covered last week, when they occur, it then drives this particle band down. And then what happens is the particle band then forms nucleuses for water droplets. That's, as a matter of fact, that's what we'll be talking about today. So that's why it becomes a danger, because a lot of that stuff that comes from Pittsburgh has already made a circuit around the world. Sometimes, of course, it comes back this way. You know, usually when we get on an airplane and fly from Chicago to here, New York to here, the plane flight is usually a lot quicker than when we get on a plane and fly from here going that way. Usually the planes are late going eastward and early coming westward because of those winds. Those winds are the ones that move these particles around.
I see.
Uh-huh. Anyway, pollutants exist as solid matter. Okay, the liquid droplets are gas. That's what they pretty much exist as. And the solid and liquid ones are called particulates. And these are some of the sizes now, so you can just get a feel for the sizes if you're listening out there. Okay, first of all, a micron is 1/1,000th of a millimeter, or 1/25,000th of an inch. Now, viruses are between 0.01 and 0.1 microns in size. Bacteria are between 1 and 25 microns in size. And when those of you that have used my ionizers or bought my ionizing machines, or have you seen the brochures that we put out on them, there's charts in the back showing particulate sizes and the kinds of particles, and these charts will relate to what size particle an ionizer could pick up. For example, I developed an ionizer that has an electrostatic precipitating grid in it, and it's the only machine in the world that will pick up particles as small as 0.1 and 0.01 microns in size. When you get into these standalone ion generators, just a little like the ion spray type machines, when you put those in the room, they aren't going to affect these small particles that go deep into your lungs and your respiratory system and cause problems. That's why it's very important to understand that electrostatic filtration is really where it's at as far as our current technology is to deal with these particle sizes. And we put charts in all our literature to show this, so you can educate yourself by just looking at the chart. Now, fog droplets are between 5 and 60 microns in size, and raindrops are between 400 and 5,000 microns in size. Particles over 10 microns in diameter can be seen with the naked eye. So this gives you an idea about particle sizes. Now, coarse dust particles larger than 10 microns in diameter, and fly ash composed of impurities remaining after coal is burned in the air, these kinds of particles settle out of the air very quickly. They're troublesome primarily, you know, around the source. These aren't the guys that get up and go from one nation to another. These are the ones that they know the boundaries. Now, fume, dust, and smoke particles ranging in size from 1 to 10 microns travel further, the distance depending mainly on their size. Particles less than 1 micron in diameter are usually called aerosols. You've heard about aerosols. And they are small enough to remain suspended in the air and move as easily and far as the wind as the air currents and gases do.
Now, are these the fluorocarbons we've heard about?
Right. Although the fluorocarbon thing, which was primarily coming out of spray cans, was just another bureaucratic poke at society to really push away the true problem of pollution, which is automobile and high-flying jets. Okay, the amount of aerosols coming from or fluorocarbons coming from a spray can is so minute on a scale of 1 to 10 versus pollution from an automobile, it wouldn't even be on the scale. It's a joke.
But I thought the problem with the fluorocarbons was that it would have a disastrous effect on the ozone layer.
Well, what they want, you got to realize that the government in the Global 2000 report has said that the most dangerous thing to the ozone layer is the high temperature jet engine exhaust of high flying jet aircraft. That's number one. Number two, when the spray can releases these different fluorocarbons, I doubt if it would ever get to the ozone layer. I'd be very surprised if any of it from any spray can ever got there because, number one, it disperses too fast. Well, what they're talking about in aerosols here are aerosols produced by high-flying jet aircraft, automobiles, and certain over residue from heavy industrial processes, not from cans. Like, for example, the manufacturing of millions of gallons of paint, for example, that kind of thing. Or someone that's making millions of gallons of kerosene or paint thinner, then there's a few fluorocarbon problems maybe right around the factory. But once again, these are not, as you'll see, these are not the main problems that we really have to concern ourselves with. Yes, they are problems. Now, smoke describes both solid and liquid particles under 1 micron in diameter. Now, it can be produced during all forms of combustion and other processes such as distillation, the removal of impurities from liquids by heating them to a boiling point and condensing the vapors. The designation smoke may also include a term that you'll hear sometimes on these reports called fume. It's spelled F-U-M-E. Fume indicates the solid particles under 1 micron in diameter that are formed as water vapors condense or chemical reactions take place. Fumes are emitted by many industrial processes, including smelting and refining. Dust is a more general term than fume. When the solid particles are more than 1 micron in size, they are generally referred to as dust. Dust may be formed by the natural attrition of different industrial and agricultural processes. And then, of course, we have mist. Mist is made up of liquid particles up to 100 microns in diameter. That's one of the problems that we have in Los Angeles is from the mist. They may be released industrially in such operations as spraying and impregnating, or formed by the condensation of vapor in the atmosphere, or by the effect of sunlight on automobile exhaust. As mists evaporate, more concentrated liquid aerosols are formed. Now, the urban atmosphere is choked with particulates. In L.A., for example, this is an old statistic here, it's back in the 70s, we got 40 tons a day of aerosols alone from automobiles. Now, that isn't from spray cans, that's just from automobiles. Well, that's not total pollution, that's just one pollution of many. An average winter day in New York produces an estimated 335 tons of particulate matter. In Kansas City, the dust fall in the winter measures more than 67 tons a square mile a month. In the most heavily polluted parts of polluted cities, from 50 to more than 100 tons of particulates fall each month per square mile. In general, the concentration of aerosols in the air over a city is related to the size of its population. Now, automobile exhaust, not confined to the city, but a great contributor to its pollution nevertheless, emits large amounts of very fine aerosols. More than two-thirds of the automobile emissions are between 0.02 and 0.06 micron in size. In the photochemical process, 100 billion particles per meter of air may evolve. Now, the properties of the particulates, okay, when these are suspended, you know, these things are suspended in the air, they oftentimes have different properties than the original substance. In other words, the air itself, because it does have oxygen in it, will cause secondary changes to take place from a primary emission from some big factory somewhere. secondary part, in Los Angeles, for example, about 35% of the particulate matter is formed by the reactions of gas pollutants. Now, whether they're primary or secondary, atmospheric particulates have some significant characteristics. Very small aerosols from 0.001 to 0.1 micron can act as nucleuses on which water vapor will condense relatively easy. Fog, ground mist, and rain may thus be increased and prolonged. Particles less than 2 or 3 microns in size, about half the weight of the particulate spent in the urban air, are estimated to be that small. These are the guys that go deep into the lungs and lodge themselves in the mucus, and they also usually carry harmful chemicals such as sulfur dioxide with them. Sulfur dioxide alone would be dissolved on the mucus before it reached that, you know, that real vulnerable tissue. Now, particles can act as catalysts, and a catalyst is a process by which a chemical change of a compound is brought about or sped up by an outside substance, yet it remains unchanged itself. Very much like, for example, an enzyme on our bodies. Enzymes go in to when we eat our foods, and they are part of the process that causes digestion and breakdown of proteins and carbohydrates and sugars. But if our body is healthy, the enzymes are not used up. Well, the inorganic part of that would be the catalyst. Now, the unchanged substance is known as a catalyst. An example of this characteristic is the change of sulfur dioxide to sulfuric acid, helped on by catalytic iron oxide. Now, aerosols can absorb radiant energy and conduct heat quickly to the surrounding gases in the atmosphere. This is what people don't realize, that aerosols do that. It increases the danger of these secondary chemical reactions. Gases that are capable of absorbing radiant energy by themselves are thus affected. As a result, the air in the contact with aerosols becomes much warmer. Now, scientists now fear, for example, that the increasing aerosol emissions of jet engines high in the troposphere may eventually form a heat-absorbing veil that will lessen the penetration of the sun's rays to the Earth. Which, you know, is kind of interesting because in the Global 2000 report, they're saying that the carbon dioxide level will cause a warming trend. So who's to say which one's going to win out? But so far, it appears that the carbon dioxide one is winning out because the temperature of the Earth is going up. Now, the latest federal figures list the major sources of pollution as, number one, transportation of all kinds, two, fuel combustion and stationary sources. Now, this category includes both fossil fuel power plants and space heatings of all buildings, three, industrial processes, four, solid waste disposal, five, miscellaneous. This includes, you know, agriculture, forest burning, solvent gasoline evaporation, and the accidental pollution of burning coal refuse piles and forest fires. This figure also gives you an estimated amount of pollution from major pollutants such as carbon monoxide, particulates, hydrocarbons, and so on. Now, next of all, we need to know, when we hear these about these smog alerts, we need to know how it's registered. You know, how do we measure the amount of pollution emission in the proportion to the amount of air. That is, so what they do is they figure out the number of parts of a pollutant for each cubic meter, and that becomes parts per million. And this information is necessary when standards for control are being set, which we have here in, of course, in Southern California. But when the effectiveness of the control methods are being assessed, or when an evaluation is being made of the danger present at any given time. Now, when we compare the pollutants in terms of either parts per million or tons per day, it's oftentimes misleading because the undesirability of any pollutant may have little to do with the amount present in the atmosphere. And a good example of this, of course, would be the presence of 0.2 parts per million of ozone, which would be 0.2% of the pollutant in one part per million parts of air. This would bring about a first stage smog alert here in Southern California. But on the other hand, if we had carbon monoxide, for example, it would take 40 parts per million, which is roughly 4,000 times as much, to bring on the same response. So this gives you an idea about how these warnings and different smog alerts come about. Now, let's look at some of the actual pollutants themselves, because I feel they're kind of important. Okay, first of all, sulfur. sulfur, whose oxides are a major reason for cities' pollution troubles, is a non-metallic element found in nature. It's either free or combined with other elements. It is almost invariably present as an impurity in coal and fuel oil, and it's released by their combustion processes. Now, the first thing that happens is you get sulfur oxides. When fuels are contained sulfur are burned, the sulfur joins with the oxygen in the air, and the gaseous oxides of sulfur are byproducts. Fuel combustion is a major source of polluting sulfur oxides, although they are produced in chemical plants and to a lesser degree by burning trash and rubbish and things like that. That's one reason, for example, remember back a few years ago, we used to burn trash in these bins behind the buildings around Southern California. But because the sulfur oxide began to get so heavy, they instigated a trash process whereby it's picked up by a local trash man and then buried. Mm-hmm. That was the reason why we went from the burning of trash locally to the picking up and carrying it off to a dump and burying it. Of course, we got to realize there's a trade-off there because we're putting a lot of poisons and viruses and bacteria into the earth that'll just grow for years. We're also polluting. Yeah, we're polluting our water supplies deep in the ground as a result of that process, too.
There is also the problem with methane gas forming and causing explosions.
That's right. The solution, I think, on that one, Jim, is from the Japanese, because they have developed processes now whereby we can take trash, burn it in a system that will produce energy, heating, electricity, things like that, pure trash, and the exhaust has even gone through catalytic converters and reduced to zero output. So I think we got to start going to total recycling. That's the only solution that we're going to really have. Now, the major oxide of sulfur that's produced in combustion now is sulfur dioxide, which is SO2. That's a heavy, pungent, colorless gas that combines easily with water vapor, which then becomes sulfurous acid, which is H2SO3. I realize sulfuric acid is what what we're going to lead into, which is sulfurous acid is a colorless liquid, and sulfurous acid is mildly corrosive, and is used as a bleaching agent, for example. And in industry, as a pollutant, it can perform the gratuitous task of adding yellow spots to the paint of your automobile. Now, what happens is it joins easily with oxygen in the air to become even more corrosive. It becomes sulfuric acid. Remember the little thing? Little Johnny is no more. For what he thought was H2O was H2SO4.
Yes, I do.
Brings it back to the old biochemistry days.
H2SO4, that's right.
Yeah, and that's what hurts a lot of Americans out there, especially out of Southern California. Sulfuric acid can be reached also by a different route. Sulfur dioxide can be oxidized. That is, it's changed chemically by combining with oxygen. So then we have sulfur trioxide, SO3. Which can be a colorless liquid or a white solid aerosol. Now, I realize now it's a very small particle to get that title. Sulfur trioxide is a likely product when combustion takes place with the excess of oxygen. The change is abetted by a catalytic action of some of the ash residue, especially the iron oxides that form on boiler tubes and walls. Now, when sulfur dioxide leaves a smokestack, it is usually diffused fairly rapidly. So the oxidation to sulfur trioxide takes place rather slowly. By that time, sulfur trioxide can build up substantially, and it reacts very quickly with water vapor to become sulfuric acid. Sulfur oxides will yellow the leaves of plants. They dissolve marble, as you see on the statues fading away in Italy, and even the Statue of Liberty was affected by it. And they eat away iron and steel. They limit the visibility. You see them here a lot in Southern California during the fall and autumn months. They cut down the light from the sun. And those sulfur oxides alone may only have, they're one irritant on man's breathing. Sulfuric acid and its particulate sulfates, compounds resulting from the reaction of sulfuric acid with a metal or alcohol, appear to be able to do significant damage to the respiratory system also. Now, a lot of people don't realize that. Once the sulfuric acid gets in the air, sort of like acid rain, for example, when it hits something, it releases another gas, and that's toxic. So people don't quite realize that this chemical process is reaching kind of like a runaway state. There are other sulfur compounds too. Hydrogen sulfide gas carries the old rotten egg smell. There's a group of gases called mercaptans that have unpleasant odors such as skunks or decaying garbage, even at low concentrations. And these gases are familiar byproducts, among other things, of petroleum refining, craft pulping, paper production, various chemical processes. I know there's a valley up there in Oregon that I used to visit that always smelled like hydrogen sulfide gas because they were doing a lot of paper processing from trees. In addition to that, the hydrogen sulfide will tarnish silverware in your house and copper. If you have a copper kettle or something, it tarnishes fast. It'll also darken the lead and paint, which then will ruin the exterior of your home. If you had your house painted, you live up, up somewhere in L.A., and it had a nice shine on it for a few months, and suddenly it got dull and dark looking, it was because the sulfur compounds just attacked it. Now, the next group of chemicals that are in our wonderful atmosphere are carbon and carbon oxides. Now, carbon is a non-metallic element found in either its pure state or a constituent of coal, petroleum, limestone, and other organic and inorganic compounds. The term organic is used here to describe the most carbon-containing compounds. Carbon is widely used as a fuel constituent, and the combustion process gives off a great deal of it, either by being partially burned or it's usually the percentage of the burning that determines how much, and most of the time, it's very poor. Now, soot is another particulate matter of carbon. It's a product of incomplete combustion. You can see it, for example, when you're driving down the freeway, some guy stands on his car to accelerate around somebody, you see that black smoke coming out of the back of it. That's because the carburetor jets aren't set for the proper altitude. You have complete combustion and they're producing soot. And it's made up of very finely divided carbon particles clustered together in long chains. Because they are so fine, the particles have an exceptionally broad surface in proportion to their weight. It is a very active surface and attracts a great variety of chemicals from the air around it. The ability for you to attract other substances makes soot not only prevalent but dangerous. Certain hydrocarbons that are known to produce cancer in animals can be absorbed on, that is, attached to the surface of soot particles and ride with them from the scene of combustion into the atmosphere. And many soot particles are small enough to carry their dangerous burdens deep into the human lungs. There are very fine forms of soot that are carcinogenic that travel in the higher winds of the atmosphere, too, and oftentimes, I know, combined with rain. Now, carbon monoxide is one that I talk about a lot because it's another product of incomplete combustion. Carbon monoxide is a colorless, odorless gas. Large amounts can be fatal. Lesser amounts can produce headache, fatigue, convulsion of dizziness. Now, what's really interesting, I think, about carbon monoxide is the effects of this gas. Number one, they're not even certain of them. Now, I'm pretty certain I know what I'm talking about because I've developed vitamins to help get rid of the effects. But in the laboratory, an 8-hour exposure to 10 to 15 parts per million impairs the ability to judge time intervals. Okay? At 30 parts per million, vision and physical response are affected. Under actual driving conditions, it is likely that people can compensate for some of these effects by increased attention. So when you're driving down the car and you start feeling irritable or your vision isn't working right or you begin to misjudge distance, realize it's carbon monoxide. For those people, however, with heart disease, even these levels can be harmful because the blood prefers carbon monoxide to oxygen and the heart has to pump harder to get enough oxygen to the body. Now, a recent survey that was conducted, it was a 15-day survey, found that people in slow-moving vehicles on the freeway in heavy traffic are at times subject to sustained levels of 50 parts per million of carbon monoxide. That's almost twice the amount that they have found in many laboratory tests where people are grossly affected. So that's why I say I don't see how people can drive on the freeways for 5 minutes without some kind of air purifying or ionization equipment in their car. And actually think that they're getting away because they don't acutely feel the effects from it. The long term effects from carbon monoxide during a relatively clear day in bumper to bumper traffic will have their toll on all human life over the period of time. Especially when you start to get older, you really start to notice the difference as you get older because your hemoglobin starts to break down, your immune system isn't as strong anymore, And I know at my age, I don't have near the vulnerability to sitting in freeway jams that I used to. When I was younger, back in my 30s and late 20s, I drove the freeways all the time, and it appeared to me that it didn't bother me any. But now I won't even go out in traffic. I'll stop and sit and get a cup of coffee in a coffee shop during heavy traffic, and I won't even get on the freeways anywhere between 4 o'clock in the afternoon and 7, even with ionization. Because I have seen how it affects me later, and how it affects me clear up into the weekend, even, you know, 8, 10, 15, 20 hours after I've been exposed to carbon monoxide.